Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
I'm Lisa Stone, and you're listening to Parenting Aces. Welcome to Season 12 of the Parenting Aces podcast, a proud member of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and this week we have with us the head women's coach from Harvard Tennis, Tracy Green. And I am so, so excited about this conversation. I have been wanting to get Tracy on the podcast for quite a while. Finally had the opportunity to meet and chat with her at the USTA National Hard Courts in San Diego this summer, and I'm just so grateful for her taking time to join us on the podcast today. If you're not familiar with the Ivy League and tennis specifically in the Ivy League, this is a great episode for you to listen to. It will give you a better understanding of what recruiting looks like, what a typical day is like, and what the financials are like at the Ivy schools. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Coach Tracy Green.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tracy Green of Harvard Women's Tennis. We are so thrilled to have you on the podcast. I'm really excited for this conversation. Thanks so much for taking time out to do this.
Thank you for having me, Lisa. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's, you know, we met at the National Hard Courts down in San Diego, and I think I told you I've been wanting to interview you for a while, and I think it's always so interesting to get coaches from different types of college tennis programs so that families understand all the different options that are available to them. And certainly having you from Harvard, from an Ivy League school, is just such an honor. So I'm looking very forward to this.
Thank you.
So to get us started, I'm going to ask you the question that I ask all of our guests the first time they come on, which is to give us a little bit of your tennis story. How did you get introduced to the sport and what was your journey like?
Sure. So my parents did not play tennis. They were fans of all sports. They liked to watch tennis on television, basketball, football, college sports especially. My mom was a professor, actually a college coach of lacrosse. So naturally, she would like to, you know, be around college sports, especially lacrosse. That was her sport, her main. I never, you know, saw them, you know, really playing tennis. I probably like once or twice, maybe on vacation. But here in the all sports youth camp, I was like 10 years old. One of the sports options was tennis. And that's mixed with like basketball and karate, like some random kind of. And I had tennis that summer and I just loved it. I just seen the boys. You know, I realized I was pretty good at doing that. And I was like, hey, hook me right there. And I gave me to keep taking lessons the next summer, the next year, progressed from that point to 3 days a week to 5 days a week, USTA tournaments, and, you know, the rest is history.
So how did you make that transition from player to coach?
Yeah, so I had a pretty cool career at University of Florida. We got to win some national championships, and I really thought I had some more gas in the tank. for pro tennis. I had some injuries, and obviously, tennis was, near and dear to me. I played for that long at super high level, and coaching, I guess, was the next step. I never thought I'd be a coach. Kind of started off with just hitting with people, being that hitting partner for juniors, for adults, and then it kind of progressed into coaching. And actually, Rodney Harmon, who's currently the coach at Georgia Tech right now, he said, "Hey, you know what? You should think about getting into coaching and getting your certification and doing X, Y, and Z." And I was like, "Really? You think so?" He said, "Yeah, we need more women coaches." So he was like the first person who sort of gave me a little nudge and said, "Hey, you should at least start going down this path."
I love that. Rodney's such a good guy. And oh, how cool that he was kind of your little nudge into the coaching arena. And he's absolutely right. We need lots more women coaches. So glad you're kind of setting the standard and paving the way there. So you're at Harvard. I mean, it's a pretty high level of tennis in general, a really high level of academics. What's it like coaching these young women who are not only great tennis players, but obviously have very high academic standards for themselves as well?
You know what, Lisa? Every day is amazing being on Harvard's campus. I'm so grateful for a job that I love, and I wake up and I, love to do every day, being around so many really cool individuals. We start with is the people, and that really is true. I mean, you go into one of the dining halls and you hear some really interesting conversations. That's the kind of people we look for to come on our teams, to be a part of our program. And it kind of fit me in a way. I love the fact that we don't have scholarships later, but the people actually play because they really want to be here for the sport, and then obviously the academics. So yeah, that really drew me into Harvard, and it's kind of what keeps me here at the same time.
Yeah, it's interesting because I did a podcast a few weeks ago with Danielle McNamara, and we talked about the importance of good grades and, how student athletes need to make sure they're keeping their grades up in order to have as many opportunities as possible to play college tennis. How much weight do you put on a student athlete's academic performance when you're looking to recruit them?
Sure. Looking at the recruiting process, it has so many different stages to it. Obviously, tennis is super important for us. We are a Division I team. We want to be ranked. We want to go to NCAAs and do some damage there. So the level of the player is always going to be pretty important, right? But it is Harvard. So we care immensely about grades. We want everyone pushing themselves academically in high school. So we look for people who really are showing that they have quite a bit of academic rigor and have shown that they have a track record of excelling in their classes. It doesn't have to be all A's, but hey, we want to see you pushing yourself and doing well. The cool thing about my job, I'm not admissions, so I get to just kind of, bring people forward. But I've been doing this for a while, and I kind of know what they like to see, and I hope it works out each year. And so far it has.
Yeah, that's awesome. What type of input do you have, and what type of weight does being a tennis player carry with the admissions office? So, I've heard some chatter lately of, kids are playing tennis and continuing to push through the juniors, even if they don't want to play varsity tennis in college, because they feel like it's going to open the admissions door for them. Is there truth to that?
Well, we love players at Harvard, at least for Harvard women's tennis, who have a lot of gas in the tank. Those people who want to play college tennis, right? Who, because they love it, who want to compete, who want to be on a team. So my job is to find those people, and admissions knows that's also my role in that process. So it'd probably be pretty easy to find a bunch of folks who sort of just play for their resume or play because their parents tell them to play or something like that. But finding those folks who truly love the game, that's what I go out to do or seek to do, every summer, every year. I like to think that our team is full of those types of people right now.
So when you're at a tournament like National Hard Courts down in San Diego, what is your role there? What is it that you're seeking to accomplish being on site?
Honestly, when I go to San Diego for hard courts, a lot of the time it's really about putting names with faces and faces with names. So you'd be surprised, you know, how many videos you get, but then how many videos you don't get, right? So just how many emails you've come across and text messages and a few phone calls, but you really haven't seen that person up close and personal. Our staff, we like to see people play at least a couple times before we, you know, have them come on a visit. Occasionally it's one time, right? If they're like, you know, amazing, we just know it's probably going to be a good fit. But seeing people play multiple times is invaluable, right? You see them play when they're playing, you know, well, maybe when they're down, when they're up. Maybe you see them playing at different stages of their tennis career. Maybe they were, you know, second year 16s, and now you see them, you know, first year 18s, and they made a couple adjustments in their game. Maybe they've grown, gotten stronger, you name it, overcome an injury, you name it. So I love recruiting. I love getting out on the road, seeing folks. It gets kind of hot, some of these locations, I must say, Lisa. Some of these locations, you're sweating the whole time. But it's fun, and I definitely enjoy it.
Yeah. And you know, I saw you at the table having conversations with players when they were allowed to talk to you after their tournament was finished, or, you know, whatever the NCAA rules allow at this stage of the game. What are some of those conversations like? What are some of the questions that are coming up? And is it you asking more of the questions, or is it the prospective student athlete asking the questions of you?
I'd say it's a combination. When we have those types of meetings where you're at a, you know, some kind of fair or symposium of coaches, occasionally you get people who haven't met you before and they want to meet you and they have specific questions they want to ask. And that's always great. It's always great when you have someone who's super organized and they know exactly what they want to, you know, get from you. And then on our side, sometimes we already, you know, met the person, or maybe once, maybe twice. And, you know, that meeting's really about just checking in. How are you? Good to see you. What time do you play? What are you working on this week? What are your goals for this tournament? Type of conversation. So it really depends on the individual. Sometimes people are just seeking out information about your school. You know, are you looking at more players that are like me right now? Like, what are you looking for? And I think that's super important for players in general, to not be afraid to ask a coach what they're looking for. Obviously, there's so many tools you can use to try to research teams and try to figure that out yourself. But sometimes we're just guessing. Some people sometimes come up to me and say, hey, I see that you're looking for a, you know, WTN this number or UTR this number. And I'm like, what makes you say that? You know, so I think just getting it directly from the horse's mouth is always a good practice. And, you know, there's no shame in the game to ask a coach directly, you know, what are you looking for? Or, you know, how many players like me are you looking for that are my year, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you mentioned WTN, UTR. How much weight do you personally put on these ratings and rankings when you're going through the recruiting process?
Sure. Well, it seems like WTN is carrying more and more weight, you know, every week. So probably definitely more with that, definitely for our college players and their rankings and things of that nature. But they're all great tools, right? They're all great tools to help us, you know, understand the level of a player and how they're moving week to week. Nothing beats the naked eye. Nothing beats seeing a match in person. Occasionally, you know, I think sometimes, you know, you can overanalyze with numbers and things like that and get all in your head. And it's funny because you look at some players on our team and some will know way more about ratings, and the younger ones will know way more than the older ones. They're like, what is that? I don't know. Like, it's this, you know, they tell them what it is. So I think it really depends on how you use it. But I think they're great tools, super useful. And it's just it's really about how you find a way to use it for your purpose.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's one of those things that I think people tend to get bogged down in the rating and ranking and forget that you still have to be able to play tennis. You still have to be able to compete. You still have to be able to get along socially. You still have to handle the academic rigor, all of those things, right? And as I tell people all the time, the good coaches know better than to rely solely on one metric. They're looking at a whole host of metrics when making decisions.
Exactly.
Have you found since you've been at Harvard that you've been able to create a certain culture? And have you seen that culture change at all over your tenure there? Or, you know, did you come in on day one and say, this is the kind of team culture I want to have, and I'm committed to making this happen and bringing players in who can support that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. So I'm one of those coaches. I rely heavily on our players to help determine, you know, our altitude, where we're going to go, right? Each season, every season is so different. You know, some years, you know, like a couple of years ago, we had the pandemic, right? So like, how was our culture that year, right? How was our culture for people who had no season and now they have, you know, season for the first time? So it's like every year, it's like you have different ingredients that you're using, you know, like let's say in the kitchen, like as a coach, you're like a chef in the kitchen. And some years you have a stocked refrigerator, like one of these cooking shows you see on Cooking Channel, right? And some years you have like an apple, right? And a pear, and that's it. What can you make with that? Like the pandemic a few years ago in the Ivy League. But you know, you got to love it, right? You have to have a strategy. You have to stand for something. We stand for family, reaching our potential, getting a little bit better every day, having fun, right? So if you stand, you know, close to your core values, you're never going to go wrong. Right now, we have a very close-knit culture, a team that, you know, we care for one another, care about academics, care about sports, we care about competing. The key word is care. So if you're for that as a coach, it really just, you know, trickles down usually the rest of your staff, the rest of your team, and hopefully your leadership. So whether you have captains or senior leaders or just regular leaders on your team, hopefully that trickles down and really emanates off everyone.
Yeah, I love that. What's a day in the life look like for a Harvard women's tennis player?
Ooh, good question. Good question.
Give us a fall scenario during tournament season, which is you're just entering, versus spring scenario where, you know, we're playing dual matches.
So fall scenario, you know, we'll have the individual tournaments. So some of our top players will be getting ready for regionals or super regionals or all American. That's what's going on like right now as we speak during this interview. So we're getting folks ready. Folks, you know, train usually the second half of the summer, a little more with more intensity to get ready for the fall season. We've done fitness testing. We're about to ramp up on our fitness. We like to like kind of load up on our fitness in the fall. So we kind of do more and have more injury preventative mindset in the spring. And yeah, that's basically how the fall goes, really individually based. Sometimes we'll have what we call hidden dual events. We have some at home. We're about to go to Notre Dame in a couple of weeks where we'll play another team. And it feels like a dual match, but it really isn't. So you get a chance to compete as an individual, but you sort of get the team feel at the same time. So we'll do a few of those. At the very end of the season, we kind of move indoors at Harvard, which is nice. So you get to go to class and, you know, you kind of have more of a set practice time. So you don't have as many, you know, small group practices because we can outside, we can go anytime you want during the day, you know. Yeah. So we have a lot of small groups, but we kind of will have more set practice times once it gets a little cooler in New England. Then we share our courts with our men's team. And then once we get to January, people go home for the break into January, and it's totally team focused. My favorite time of the team season is January. People come back ready to go, ready to get working. We usually try to sprinkle in some ranked opponents. We sprinkle in what we call ECACs, which is a tournament that we play generally with other Ivy League schools. It's always fun to mix it up and play a 3-day tournament where you're playing other Ivy school. That's always fun. You hear me say fun a lot because I feel like competing is fun, and we try to make it fun mentally for our team. So yes, it's going to be a challenge, but we think everything's going to be fun. It's just the way how we're going to approach it, right? And then we go on to our spring trip, and then after that we have our Ivy season, which again is more fun. We have a home and away situation in the Ivy League, so every year you either play another school home or you play them away. We don't have a tournament, which is pretty interesting, you know, Ivy League tradition right now. So right now we don't have a tournament. So it's basically your win-loss record. So every match counts, which makes
and it. But that determines whether or not you get into the end of the year NCAA tournament, correct?
Exactly. So the team with the highest, with the best results, the best record is the team that wins the conference championship. And there can be a tie, you know, because there are eight teams and there could be a tie. Or there is a tie some years. And the team that's the highest ranked nationally gets to go to NCAAs. And that's happened, you know, a few years. Sometimes it's a three-way tie, right? But that's the beauty of the Ivy League. You never know what's going to happen. We have so much parity in the league, which makes it very fun.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago about the fact that Ivies don't have athletic scholarships. Other than that, what makes the Ivy League different from other Division I conferences?
Honestly, you know, not a ton. I can only really speak to, you know, Harvard specifically. That's what I know best. But for Harvard, I mean, budgetarily, I think we like to compete with, you know, some of the top schools out there as much as we can. You know, we offer, you know, everything you can think of to support our players, whether it's, you know, rackets, stringing, massages, you name it. We have to come visit and talk to me to know all the details, right? And I can't give it all away right here on this podcast. But yeah, you know, we try to make things you know, get people what they need, right? All the tools they need to be successful, to be a cohesive team, you know, whether it's mental training, whether it's, you know, additional workouts with the fitness coach, you name it. And I think, you know, again, I'm grateful to be at a school where we do have a great budget, and we have friends that care deeply about our program and alums that care deeply about our program and the direction that it's going and that it's gone. And yeah, I mean, it's I'd say we're very, very competitive with top schools.
At what point in the recruiting process do you want a prospective student athlete to start talking budget with you? Like, is that something that comes up at the beginning of the process or later on? And what is that conversation at a school that doesn't offer athletic scholarship?
It's important to understand that we don't have athletic scholarships in the Ivy League, and specifically at Harvard. In our conversations, it's important to bring it up pretty early, because you hate to get all the way down, you know, in conversation and you say, oh, you don't have any scholarships. Oh, I thought you had scholarships, right? So it's good to bring it up early. Sometimes people don't quite understand what that truly means and what the value of an Ivy League education truly is. So I suggest people do their research and find all the, you know, amazing talented people who've graduated from the Ivy League, who are amazing tennis players, who are doing amazing things in their work life and just in general after they graduate. So for us, it's a relationship, you know, like that you have while you're in school, and the relationship that you have after you have after you graduate. And it's pretty darn unique. And you're part of the, you know, super elite club, and some people just like that. You know, obviously our brand is universal, and we love that.
Yeah. How important is it to you personally to have a mix of American and international players on the team, or focus one side or the other? And is that something that you consciously decide as you're recruiting for a particular class?
So someone told me a while ago that tennis in the NCAA is the most international sport in the NCAA. It's not soccer. It's not fencing. You know, it's not, you know, volleyball. It's tennis. So we are the most in Division I. We are the most international sport. So I don't think we can stop, you know, the international, players, you know, coming to play and getting scholarships and taking quote unquote spots, and, you know, in the States and you know, U.S. schools. However, you know, I think it is important to have some kind of a balance on most teams. Some teams they can't, right? Specifically at Harvard, we have a few folks from other countries right now. I think we have about three. We've got like Canada, Lithuania, and I think England, something like that. And we have like, I think 12 players on our team. So not so many. You know, every year is a different year. I don't think I go out, you know, seeking someone from this country or that country. It's really how recruiting shakes out. I think we just committed someone recently from another country. I can't say the name because that's against NCAA rules. But every year is so different. And I love diversity on our team. You know, diversity of where geographic diversity, where you're from, and I think it's super important to have different game styles, people who have different vibes on your team. I think that makes a team special and interesting and unique.
I agree with you. And people that have been listening to this podcast a while know that I've kind of changed my tune around all this. Once my son went to college and met his best friend / roommate / teammate, who's from New Zealand, who he now lives with in Auckland. It made me understand even more the value of having a diverse population on the team, because college is a time you're supposed to learn about other cultures and other people and other ways of life. And it's supposedly a time where you start questioning who you are and who you want to be post-college. And so I think it's super valuable, but I also understand the concern from some people that feel like, when you look at a roster that there's not a single American player, that's can be problematic from another angle. But I think it's really cool that diversity is part of your mission and your recruiting process and helping all of these young women learn about people from different cultures, different backgrounds, whether it's different countries or not. We all come with our own story. So very cool that you provide a space for them to share and learn from each other. I love that. I love that. So I want to ask you also about this whole idea of being at an Ivy and the academic rigor of being at an Ivy and how your student athletes balance their academic pursuits with their athletic pursuits. Are there certain majors that are just no-goes if they want to play college athletics, specifically tennis? Or have you found that you've had players that were able to pursue all different types of majors?
That's a great question. Balancing high-level tennis, right? High-level D1 tennis with academics is probably a balancing act at any school these days, right? And depending on how the tennis shakes out. But that's where my job comes in, I think, I've been doing this, for a few years now, a little over 15 years. And I truly do believe I know what it takes to be successful at a school like Harvard. And I try to find people who fit that background, right? Fit that profile. And, once we find them, or think we find them, we dig a little deeper just to make sure. You never know, right? But you dig a little deeper just to make sure. And you have a lot of phone calls, you have visits, you have conversations, you talk to people who know the recruits, just to really make sure that's the right fit, because you do have to push yourself at the junior level, at the high school level. You have to be pushing yourself academically, pushing yourself in the tennis at the same time. So if you're doing both at the same time, you're going to come to college and do both at the same time. So you can't just do one, just tennis and, medium school, or just medium tennis and the hard school, and just expect to come to a school like Harvard and really excel. So in our team, we do excel. We had over 3.8 GPA last year, and same thing the year before. And that comes from, them already knowing how to do that and learning, during their freshman year, how to get used to the, time management, vibe. And I think that's true at any school, your freshman year, your first year, getting used to time, managing your own time, being away from mom and dad, and just figuring out, the rhythm of the school and how things flow. But that's the biggest thing. I feel like we do bring those folks who are already quote unquote qualified, and admissions wouldn't admit you at my school, unless you were qualified. So that takes this for me in some respects, takes some of the heavy lifting, out of my hands, right? If the person is not qualified, they probably won't get in. And it doesn't happen very often, because typically we try to get those kids who probably are going to get in.
Gotcha. But in terms of majoring, once they are on campus, are there, I mean, we've heard stories where at certain schools, you can't pursue pre-med, you can't pursue, you know, courses that require lab time because of the practice schedule, because of the match schedule and all of that. Is that the case at Harvard as well?
Yeah, you know what? So our fall and our spring are pretty different seasons. So if we have a player on our team who wants to do something that's a little bit more time sensitive, I call it, let's say we call it majors concentrations at Harvard, something like computer science, right? Which is like a hot concentration these days. You know, I suggest that they take, you know, tougher, more time intensive classes in the fall, because the fall, after the fall matters, right? And in a minute, I think we'll have NCAAs in the fall. So who knows, it's going to all be turned around next year. But generally, they'll take their harder classes in the fall. And they're right on track to do everything they need to do in the spring. And we definitely encourage folks to take what they're interested in. We don't have any restrictions on majors or concentrations at Harvard or on my team. So if someone wants to do pre-med or, you know, government and to what schools, we don't have like pre-med actually. You can take courses that get you ready for medical school. But yeah, we don't have any restrictions. It's really about you doing what you're interested in. And our upperclassmen, our older players, will sort of guide people in the right direction and say, hey, I know you want to take this class, but just know you have a lot of reading in that class and you have this class. That's a lot of homework, you know, during the season. Don't you want to like have at least one class where you're, they'll say, oh yeah, you know, you're right. And so just balancing is the key at our program, at our school, really just balancing. So if you're doing the work and you're putting the time in, you're going to be okay. But just having a good balance that you're not super stressed out or not having balance in your life, because we do need to have, you know, a social life. We do need to have, you know, make time for our, you know, our friends, our family, and everything that counts.
Yeah. Getting back to the recruiting process, what is the role, in your opinion, of the parents during the recruiting process?
I think parents are super important. I mean, you know, someone told me once that, you know, I meet people for 2 years or 1 year, and now they're on my team. And the parents have known these people and raised these people for 16, 17 years, right? So they're super influential, and you need them on your team. You have to understand them and be teammates with them to a certain degree. You know, we're all in it together. You know, I don't love, you know, when parents get too involved, right?
Yeah.
I think you have to kind of separate a little bit from your child. That's part of the maturation process, you know, letting go a little bit. That's easier for some parents than others. I'm not going to name any names, but that's a part of my job too, is to help them separate. Mm-hmm. You know, that they know that they're coming to a place where the coach cares about them and cares about their well-being, care about the tennis, but care about the whole person, right? I think that's super important for them to know, and know that they can, you know, come to me with anything, right? And I'm going to do my best to be there for them and help them in any way I can. And our staff, you know, feels the same way. So knowing that they have like that line of defense there during this, you know, education process, I think that's the key. But again, it's easier for some folks than others. Easier, you know, said than done also. But yes, their parents are crucial. We love them coming to our matches, being supportive, and just that, you know, being supportive is what we need.
When you're meeting with recruits, though, let's say like at San Diego, are you also talking to the parents there, or do you really want to have the recruit, you know, lead the conversation and focus on just the recruit?
Sure. It's also, it's always great to have the parents there and get to know them. At the same time, we really do need to get to know the player who's coming to your program. They are related because they're from the same family. They are, you know, it's, you know, if it's Amy Johnson coming, it's her whole family that's coming to Harvard usually, right? They feel like, all right, we're coming to Harvard too. But you got to get to know Amy, the recruit. This fictional character I just made up is no Amy, but how is Amy? Like, how does Amy think? You know, how I got to get inside Amy's head and figure out what Amy wants. And sometimes it's hard to do parents are right there if they're answering all the questions. So occasionally we do separate. So we get to have Amy, you know, by herself. If I've already spent a quality, you know, a good amount of time with Amy, maybe I do want the parents there. Maybe we have a Zoom. Maybe we have them at a meeting, at a tournament or something like that. So we all can be on the same page, because we do need to be on the same page, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Amy does have parents who are probably paying something, you know, or, you know, helping with her organization and just helping her get where she needs to go and achieve her goal. So Amy needs to recognize that as well. But yeah, I think they're a huge part of the equation. It's just we do like to hear the player's voice as much as possible in the process.
Yeah, love that. How far in advance do you recruit? There's so much speculation, you know, among the parents chit-chatting at tournaments and stuff. Oh, you know, if a coach hasn't tapped you by the time you're in eighth grade, you know, you have no hope in going to that school. Is that true?
Honestly, you know, I feel like sometimes I feel like I'm in a bubble in the Ivy League, you know, occasionally. So we just start when NCAA allows us. You know, and that's, you know, what is it, you know, June, July, whatever the date is, right? We can reach out and talk to people. That's when we start. You know, again, I love it because it's kind of like turning a whole new chapter on people going into their junior year. And we're not in a super rush generally at Harvard, because it is a process of understanding the people, getting to know people. Now, occasionally there are people you've seen play before they get to be a rising junior. So you've heard about them, you've seen them maybe a little more in the phenom category, but those conversations don't take place until you know, until you're allowed. So the anticipation aspect, which I love, and you know, and you just never know. You never know who's out there. And now with international tennis, you know, that makes the you know, recruiting pool even wider.
Right. And just a reminder to everybody, the coaches can't reach out to the player until the summer before junior year, but the players can reach out to the coaches anytime. So, you know, if you're interested in a particular program or a particular coach, there's no harm in sending emails and making that introduction, even though they can't engage with you until after your junior year. So just a reminder for that. Don't wait until the last minute. What else do we need to know about Harvard tennis and recruiting at the Ivy League? Anything I've left out?
I mean, we were looking for people from all walks of life, not just Americans, international, you know, all over, you name it, no specific part of the country, and do reach out. Like you said, you know, sometimes we miss people at tournaments. I do use WTN. I will look at all the tools. However, you know, we're only, you know, 2 or 3 people on staff, so we might miss some folks. So do reach out. Do send an email. Do send updates on how you're doing at tournaments and your progress. And just because you don't hear back right away doesn't mean we don't read the emails or read the correspondence. I think it's super important to keep coaches updated, because then that kind of puts the ball in their court for the next move. And once you do have that, you know, time to communicate with the coach, or the opportunity to communicate with the coach, ask the right questions, be ready to go, be buttoned up. Be ready to ask the right questions so you can get information you need to make the right choice for the rest of the process.
Can you tell if a prospective student athlete has done their research on Harvard and on you as a coach and on your team? I mean, and how important is that to you when you're recruiting?
Generally, I feel we can tell when people have done research. I feel like we have a pretty solid history tennis-wise. via our results, they can tell that we've, you know, we're a pretty solid program. So I think folks who are just starting out tennis, if they shoot us an email, you know, we know right away, probably, you know, having done a lot of research. You know, I've been playing for 1 year. I'm really interested in your progress. Like, okay, well, this might not be for you. But, you know, then you have folks who really, you know, do their research, and they're mentioning stuff about our matches and just all types of facts that, you know, I would find interesting. So you really can find the difference. But the key thing is just really putting yourself out there and presenting the coach with the best parts about you as the recruit.
Yeah. Yeah. You also mentioned that once the indoor season starts up in the Northeast, that y'all are sharing the indoor facility with the men's team. How much interaction is there between the men's and the women's team at Harvard? Because I know at a lot of schools, the teams are completely separate. They rarely travel together. You know, they really don't have much interaction. And then other programs, there's tons of overlap and they're out supporting each other at their own, you know, their matches. And yes. So what's the culture like at Harvard?
Sure. So our teams are super close. You know, we share a lot of the same facilities, and you know, my Zoom background is our indoor courts. We have six beautiful indoor courts there behind me. Some mornings we split the courts 3 and 3, and we'll have individual work going on. That's pretty typical on, you know, 2 or 3, you know, mornings a week. Afternoons we split times. We have like a slot for the men and we have a slot for the women in the afternoon. So we're used to sharing. Outdoor courts right now, we have 18. So sharing is a little bit easier. We're outside. We're very fortunate for that. And coming to matches, I mean, the men's matches are, I mean, I still can't get over how loud our Harvard men's matches are. I mean, you have people, you know, cheering, you know, their butts off, you know, from start to finish. Women's side, they come support us. We support them. Our seasons are just, you know, just so exciting, both of them, right? We're both chasing different things, different parts of the season, you know, sharing the ups and downs. And the students are truly friends, right? Some of them are in the same classes. So it's pretty hard not to support each other when you're in the same classes and you're sharing the same facilities and you're seeing them pretty much every day. So very grateful for having, you know, two close teams.
Yeah, love that. Anything I've forgotten to ask you? We're coming toward the end of our hour, and I want to make sure I give you the platform to, you know, share the Harvard gospel with us.
Honestly, you know, I do encourage folks to really give the Ivy League a chance, give the Ivy League a shot. We don't have scholarships, but, you know, we generally have an amazing experience that's worth so much more. I can speak for Harvard, you know, just an amazing experience. And it's, you know, you can't go wrong being at one of the best schools in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And even though there aren't athletic scholarships, there is other financial support available. And I know, you know, the Harvard Bursar's office, or I think it's the Bursar's office, is where you would go to find out what other financial support is available, loans, scholarships, work study. There's always ways to fund your education, even when there's not a tennis scholarship on the table.
Yes, financial aid is abundant here. So we suggest people who think they need aid, because we are a need-based program, you know, come and figure out what you need. You know, have your parents, you know, use the financial aid calculator, see what comes up. It's not always a hard number, but they work with you. And again, you know, this experience is like no other. And I'm not saying that just because I work at Harvard. I am biased because I do work at Harvard, but it's an amazing experience, and, you know, it's like no other.
Yeah. Love it. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. If it's okay with you, I'm going to share your contact info in the show notes on parentingaces.com. So for any of you watching, if you have questions for Tracy about the Harvard Women's Tennis Program, please do reach out to her. She's incredibly responsive, even though she's one of the busiest people I've ever come across. I want everyone to feel like an Ivy education, an Ivy tennis experience is out there and is available if that's something that you want. And don't write it off just because they don't have athletic scholarships, or don't write it off just because you don't have a 4.5 GPA. You may still be a great fit, right?
Amen. Yes, it's an amazing experience. You know, you get to play people in this region. You're not flying all over the, you know, you're staying right here, meeting amazing people. You have experience of your life. So I definitely encourage it. So, you know, work hard in school. That's the first step. Work hard in school and on the court, and be a good person. And then you're one step, you know, one step in the right direction to come into a school like Harvard.
Perfect. Perfect. To my listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We will catch you next time on Parenting Aces.
I'm Lisa Stone, and you've been listening to the Parenting Aces podcast. For tennis parents, by a tennis parent. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to us and write a review on iTunes. For more information on navigating the junior and college tennis journey, please visit us online at parentingaces.com. Thanks for tuning in and sharing us with your tennis community.